We ready to live stream? Very good. Okay, very good. So welcome everybody to today's Sutta class. We just had a committee meeting, so actually on time. It's pretty good. And today we have the Sapurasa Sutta. So those of you who got your piece of paper, it's very good. So off we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I chose this sutta today. I'm sure it's been done before and it's probably somewhere on the recorded talks. It's one of my favorite ones because not only does it talk about what became known later on as spiritual materialism, so we're not into attainments, into ego, we're into just letting go and not thinking that we're better than anybody else. And it has it, one of my favorite, whatever you conceive it to be, it's always something else. Also, gives a description like of the path of practice to people. Now this is being translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his Majjhima Nikaya, but I have adapted it to Ajahn Brahm's way of talking. So this is the Ajahn Brahm version of the Sapurasa Sutta with some different words, different translations than you would see in the books. Otherwise, if you really wanted to do this one or see this, you can just read it in a book. But what you're going to hear today is slightly different, a few different translations. So here we go. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in Jeta Groves and Anathapindika's park. And for those of you who don't know that story, Anathapindika, a very rich guy, wanted to get a monastery for the Buddha and the monks at that time. And so he wanted to buy this park from this aristocrat called Prince Jeta. Prince Jeta said, I wouldn't even sell it to you if you covered every inch of the ground with gold. And he said, okay, done. And so he said, no, that was only a metaphor. And he took him to court, and the judge actually ruled in Anathapindika's favor. If you cover every inch of this land with gold coins, then it's yours. And being very rich, he could do that, and he was about to finish. And then Prince Jeta thought, wow, this is really something, so much gold and more than he needed. And he said, okay, the rest of it is my donation. So even though Anathapindika paid for most of it, a little bit was actually supplied by Prince Jeta. That's why it's called Anathapindika's Park, otherwise known as Jeta's Grove. So both of them offered it to the Sangha. And that's where the Buddha spent most of his life as a monk. And those of you who go on pilgrimage to India, you can go there and see the place identified by archaeologists as the real Jeta Grove and Anathapindika's park where the Buddha lived. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, I shall teach you the character of a skillful person and the character of an unskillful person. And in the original translation said a true person and an untrue person. That doesn't really make much sense to me. I think skillful is much better. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the monks replied. The Blessed One said this. What is the character of an unskillful person? Here, an unskillful person has gone forth from an aristocratic family. Gone forth means become a monk or a nun. Consider thus. I have gone forth from an aristocratic family. But these other bhikkhus, these other monks, have not gone forth from aristocratic families. So they praise themselves and disparage others because of their aristocratic family. That's the character of an unskillful person. But a skillful person considers thus. It is not because of one's aristocratic that states of greed, hatred, or delusion are destroyed. Even though someone may not have gone forth from an aristocratic family, yet if they have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way, which is basically the Eightfold Path, and they conduct themselves according to the Dhamma, They should be honored for that. They should be praised for that. So putting the practice of the way first, they neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their aristocratic family. That's the character of a skillful person. And it goes on to say, moreover, an unskillful person who has gone forth from a great family, from a wealthy family, from an influential family, considers us. I have gone forth from an influential family, but these other monks have not gone forth from influential families. So they praise themselves and disparage others because of their influential family. This too is a character of an unskillful person. But a skillful person considers thus, it is not because of one's influential family, wealthy family or whatever, that states of greed, hatred or delusion are destroyed. Even though someone may not have gone forth from an influential family, yet if they have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way, and conduct themselves according to the Dhamma, they should be honored for that. They should be praised for that. So putting the practice of the way first, they neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their influential family. This too is the character of a skillful person. So this was even saying that sometimes people think just because of their family were wealthy, aristocratic, influential, that makes them somehow better. And that was even going on within a monastic community. And the Buddha was making very clear that that has got nothing to do with praise or blame. In fact, what you should be praising more than anything else is the way that a person practices, is, even if they come from a not such a good family. And of course, I think you all may know that, I mean, Sri Lankans here, there is one sect of Buddhism in Sri Lanka which will not allow Sri Lankans from a lower caste to join their order. And it's disgusting, it's racism. But it's still there. I think it was what happened once, there was one of their monks, he was from a poor family, and I think one of the Sri Lankan kings came along, and this monk bowed to the king or something. And when the other monk said, no, we're higher than the king. And he said, you have shamed us, so we never allow anybody like that to ordain in our group again. And it's like racism. It's just, we'd only have influential people join our order. And that is totally against Buddhism. But of course, in some societies, you are judged by what type of family you come from. Fortunately, in Australia, we don't have that at all. In fact, if you come from a convict family, then you are like the elite. They usually say the creme de la crimes. But, over here. But where I grew up in England, it's amazing that still is really an important part. Now, what is your family? Where are you from? And especially if you've got some aristocratic family, that somehow that makes you different. So anyway, here we're saying the family has nothing to do with it, and especially caste, which was important in India, still is in India, has nothing to do. But what is important is whether you have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way, conducting yourself according to the Dhamma, not your family. So number four. Moreover, an unskillful person who is well known and famous considers us. I am well known and famous, but these other bhikkhus are unknown. And I can be legit famous, but this monk sitting next to me, he's unknown. That'd be terrible if you believe that sort of stuff. It'd be disgusting. So it should be. But there are people who think like that, unfortunately. And if they think like that, that's the character of an unskillful person. An unskillful person is well known and famous, can thus, I am well known and famous, but these other bhikkhus are unknown of no account. So they praise themselves and disparage others because of their renown. That too is a character of an unskillful person. It's not because of one's renown that states of greed, hatred or delusion are destroyed. Even though someone may not be well known and famous, yet if they have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, enters upon the proper way, and conduct themselves according to the Dhamma, they should be honored for that. They should be praised for that. So putting the practice of the way first, they neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their renown. This too is the character of a skillful person. And I've known some old monks years ago in Thailand who had no renown at all, who were considered by their local villagers just to be another old, just, you know, no one to look after them, so just living in the hut, you know, not even, and just, basically a no. Particular monk have something. The monk said he was fully enlightened, and he had an interesting story. It's nice to have little stories about some of the old monks I used to know. An ordinary villager, and he was just doing some business in Thailand, and it just happened to be that day was the funeral of Ajahn Chah's teacher, Ajahn Mun. So he just, what's going on, just went in for a look, and he heard one of the monks give the talk, and they said, all you need to do to get enlightened is sit meditation a lot, walk meditation a lot. And he was so inspired just by that simple teaching that he told his wife he wanted to become a monk, became a monk, had no other teacher, and just kept on sitting meditation or walking meditation. And apparently that when he was doing walking meditation, when he got tired, he just sat down where he was and just meditated there. When he finished sitting down meditation, he'd get up and carry on walking again. And when he felt really tired, he'd lay down and just sleep on the walking meditation path. And that was his practice. So simple, just, wonder that he became an enlightened being. And the reason why we know that, or, some of the stuff which he gave out, which indicates he certainly had something, was when one of our monks was visiting him, and just you chat to monks, especially, if you know a bit of Thai, chatting about all sorts of things. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Australia. Oh, where's that? It's down south. So how far south? Past Bangkok? Because he didn't have any idea of geography, because many of those old monks had only done 1, 2, 3, 4 years of education. Yeah, and if you go a bit further than Australia, you come to the South Pole. What's it like at the South Pole? Because he'd never done any geography. Oh, it's lots of ice and snow. It's really cold down there. Oh, really? That's interesting. Because he'd never heard things like that before. And the next morning, when they went on arms round, he said, oh, yeah, you're totally right. Because it's really cold down there, and there's lots of ice and lots of mountains of ice. I just went there last night. And he wasn't making this up. This was a really great monk. But the people in the village never knew what he was up to. Just a little old monk who would just go out for alms and just sit in his hut and walk all day. So those are sometimes people of renown. They haven't got anything. But people who just sit here know what he does. So, they do know now, yeah. So, but it's not with your family, nothing to do with the spiritual life. Plentiful rice and medicine. These are called the four requisites, the basic necessities of clothes to wear, a place to stay, food and medicines when you're sick. These are the basic things. And because monks in those days, that's all you would get. But some people had a lot of robes of the very best qualities. And their alms food was really the top quality. And so they sometimes think that that meant that they were better than other people. And I get much more than you do. These days, I'm telling you about what monks sometimes say. Sometimes they say, how many disciples have you got? Or how big is your center? Or, it's crazy, sometimes, we have this big alms offering at the end of the year called the Katina. They would ask each other, how much money did you get at your Katina? And you say, 10,000, that's nothing. Sometimes, spiritual materialism, how that comes, or how big is your hall? And so, you've got a big hall here, I've got to make a bigger one. Unfortunately, the Anglicans or the Catholics. The Catholics just did an extension. So the Protestants, we've got to do a bigger extension. Unfortunately, you do get that sort of stuff. Is it quite clear? It's not because things and requisites of medicine, but these are the bhikkhus themselves and disparage others because of their gain. This unskillful person. With the Dhamma, according to the Dhamma, they should be honored and praised for that. Disparage others because of gain. Poor person. Moreover, an unskillful person who is learned. You know, they've got a lot of knowledge about Buddhism. Who is an expert in the monastic rules, a discipline, who is a great preacher of the Dhamma, or who lives, I'll stop there for a little bit, that they think that somehow or other that they are great better than those bhikkhus who aren't learned or teachers, experts in the Vinaya or teachers of the Dhamma. But again, it's not because of your learning, whether that you're a good monk or good nun or good layperson or not, it's whether you have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way and conduct yourself into the Dhamma. So you put the practice of the way first, and neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of them being learned or expert in discipline or a preacher of the Dhamma. So just because you're better than any. So please, I preach the Dhamma, I am learned in the Dhamma, but please do not treat me as something special. The next one, those who are forest dwellers, wear of patched robes, who eat only food given on alms round, who live under trees or live in a cemetery in the open air, who never lie down, who has no regular lodgings, who only eats one meal a day. Those are called the seven austere practices, which are optional for any monk or any nun. So this is just making your life even more simple. For example, they say, where is it gone again? Who lives in a forest instead of in the city. Now the forest, that was a word, I should have actually changed that. It's actually a wilderness. It's actually defined as more than 1 kilometer away from the nearest dwelling. In other words, that if you're too far away from any land, it can be dangerous for you. It's one of the reasons why the Buddha said that bhikkhunis are not permitted to stay in a forest in that time. And if you've got Gichi Ganup, stand in there to... Okay. And Google Maps, and I found out that they just get in. They're not legally a forest monastery because the nearest house is actually closer than 1 kilometer. It's about 950 meters. I measured it. So the bhikkhunis can stay there. So a forest monastery isn't a monastery with trees. It could be in a desert, in a mountain. It's a wilderness area which is away, from many people. So whenever you hear this word, which is overused these days, the forest tradition, forest monks, it doesn't mean in their place they've got a few trees. It means they're actually, quite a long way away, from other people. And that is what is called a forest monastery. Now, segregated, separated from villages, towns and houses. And there are many forest monasteries I used to know in Thailand. They were forest monasteries a long time ago, but the pressure of urbanization or people trying to find places to stay meant the villages have got much closer to them. So, unfortunately, and even I remember in other traditions too, going to a Heiji monastery, which was in Japan, where a very great Zen master, Dogen, that's where he set up the Soto Zen tradition. And that was such a simple monastery when he was alive, but after, 800 years, first of all a few houses just outside the gate, and now a village, and now a town. And because it's a tourist place, you can buy souvenirs, you can have all sorts of restaurants and hotels to stay the night. It's like a town outside what was once like a forest wilderness monastery. Unfortunately, that's just what happens. So I'd imagine that after a while we'll have a big village outside Dhammasara Monastery and another big town outside of Bodhinyana. I don't know, and selling different models of Ajahn Brahm and Venerable Kinabija. I don't know what will happen. Little teacups with Ajahn Brahm on the outside. Anyway, so that's a forest monastery, but old forest monasteries were always much more simple, and not many people would go there because they were afraid of animals. So it would be quite austere to live in a forest. And it would also be austere to wear patched robes. In other words, whenever your robe got a cut in it, you put a patch on it, and then another patch on top of the patch, and another patch on top of the patch on top of the patch. And so instead of actually just wearing these robes which people give you in abundance these days, you'd actually make as your determination known, not to receive these ready-made robes, but to make them out of scraps of cloth. We've done that before, I've done that before, and I remember Ajahn Bhamani, he had this robe along, I was very proud of his robe, it had so many different colours on it, that he looked like one of these clowns in the circus. Which is okay when he's staying in the monastery. When he started travelling, it doesn't really give the immigration department much confidence. You can look after yourself. So I was afraid he'd get refused entry into one of these countries. So patch robes is okay, but if you travel, please don't do that. The only food giving on alms round meant that the monks or the nuns, they would go with their bowl into the village and they would just eat whatever they got given on that day. Any people who brought food to the monastery, they brought mushy peas or they brought whatever else you bring to the monastery, they wouldn't eat that at all. They just eat what they got on alms round. And of course, we all give that a try every now and again. It's actually quite humbling, sort of when you find very poor people just actually give you some food. And one of the events which I always remember that one of our monks once, when we had our global, that global conference, as you know, all the monks and the nuns who came, there was always food provided. But he said, no, I won't take food, no provided, I'll take my bowl and just go walking through Perth City, see if I can get some alms food. And, it's amazing that, and he said sometimes he saw a homeless man had a sandwich and the homeless man had to put it in this monk's bowl. And he ate it. And he said, it was just so inspiring, to actually just go out for alms. And he had a full bowl, actually not a full bowl, but plenty to eat. And that takes a lot of trust, and it's a very beautiful thing to do. So, okay, the homeless man, I think they usually get enough food, but he got some merit. Amazing. So that's, when we do that as a regular practice, to eat only alms food. We won't eat what's brought to the monastery. And there is, what's the next one, who lives only under trees. So you can do that for 9 months of the year, but when it's the rainy season, you have to have a hut. But outside of that, you can go out and just live out under the trees. That was part in my training. Even though we all had huts for at least 1 month every year, just as a training, Ajahn Chah said, right, get out of your huts, go sleep under the trees in the forest. Which was a nice idea, because they'd have a mosquito net, and you watch all these snakes crawling past, just over here, and venomous ones. I don't know why, it was only a little, very thin mosquito netting, but you felt secure and safe. Totally, really ridiculous. And big snakes as well, and all sorts of other little creatures. But worst of all, that what we did know at the time, that there were these mites living in the leaves, which carry scrub typhus, and that's where many of our monks got scrub typhus, and that's a whole different story. But it was actually in the cold season in Thailand, it was much warmer down there. So it was actually quite comfortable in one sense. So a person who just lives under a tree for 9 months of the year, or who just lives in a cemetery. Now, even Westerners are scared of ghosts. People say, I'm not scared of ghosts. Wait till you see one. in the dark. You're not quite sure what it is. Of course, people would be a bit scared. But especially Asians are terrified of ghosts. So actually to go and sleep the night in a cemetery is a really big thing for an Asian person to do. So that's one of the things which the monks do. And of course, being a Westerner, you weren't so afraid of the ghosts. So when I did go wandering through Thailand, sometimes all these lay people would come and bother you. And it was Ajahn Chah, he told me, he said, look, if you want a nice quiet night, ask where the cemetery is and go and stay there all night. You know, no lay person would come and ask you any questions because they'd be terrified of going to the cemeteries. So that was also an austere practice to go and hang out with the ghosts. And so you're living in a cemetery or in the open air, that's not even under a tree, just out in the open, which will be really, really unpleasant with the heat. Or someone who never lies down, you're always in a sitting position or walking, so even you go to sleep sitting up rather than lying down. And of course, you know, we all learned how to do that for a while. So, you know, I think most monks did that. I remember doing it for 2 weeks, never lying down for 2 weeks. And all that really taught you how to do is to go to sleep when you're sitting. And that was very bad for my meditation because then, you know, it took me years to actually to go to sleep when you're meditating. So that's really all you learned. That's what I learned from that anyway. So I don't recommend that, doing the, call it the sitter's practice. Whereas no regular lodgings, you just go from place to place. And lastly, who only eats one meal a day. And that means just one bowl, one sitting, and you don't have a breakfast. Or if you have a breakfast, you don't have a lunch. If you have a lunch, you don't have a breakfast. That means just the one meal a day practice. And those are called some of the austere practices, which are optional to people. But with each one of these things, this is an unskillful person thinks, I eat only one meal a day, but these other bhikkhus, they eat many times. They eat themselves and disparage others because of their being a one meal a day eater, or because they are aware of patched robes, or eat food only given on alms round, who live only under trees, or in a cemetery in the open air, never lie down, never have any lodgings. For each one of these, they praise themselves and put down others. And that's the character of an unskillful person. But the skillful person considers thus, it is not because of greed, hatred or delusion are destroyed. Even though someone may eat more than one meal a day, yet if they have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way, and conduct themselves according to the Dhamma, they should be honored for that. They should be praised for that. So putting the practice of the way first, they neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their following one of these austere practices. That too is the character of a skillful person. And of course I've seen that many times. People think the more austere, the better you are. And that is the character of an unskillful person. So it's not whether you're famous, whether you get lots of stuff, whether you live in a cemetery or in a forest, you eat one meal a day or anything like this. That is not the cause for praise or blame. It's whether you have entered upon the way that accords with the Dhamma, entered upon the proper way, and conduct yourself according to the Dhamma. In other words, where you are lessening states of greed, hatred, and delusion. So I'm just going to pause there to see if there's any questions so far, to get the simple message of this sutta. Okay, so now we get... Oh, yeah. You get used to it. You get used to it. And I was young at the time. When you're young, you do anything. At least you think you can. So, you know, some monks would do it really tough and they would not lean against anything. They would just sit up. And usually they'd slump. You know, when you get very tired at night, you just slump. And you learn how to go to sleep in that posture. And you wake up in the morning and you try and straighten yourself up. You would walk. And you would stand, but you would never actually lie down. And some monks, when I did it, I allowed myself to lean against the wall. So you lean against the wall when you were at night time to go sleep that way, but without sort of sitting down. It was like flying to London in economy class. You can't lie down, you just have to go to sleep somehow that way. And he managed to do it. I remember when I did that, because after a couple of days you were really groggy, you didn't have any proper sleep. When I leant against the wall, I didn't notice, because I was sleeping, there was a scorpion, so it stung my head. That meant I wasn't sleepy after that. No. It really hurt. It went away afterwards. Not with a scorpion on it. Sorry? The scorpion, no, poor scorpion, you know, because I went back, you know, before he stung me, he killed him, poor thing. And he squashed him. It was self-defense on the scorpion's part. It was only because you weren't mindful, because if you go without sleep, you lose a lot of mindfulness. And many monks tried that, and after a while you just, again, you learn how to go to sleep sitting up. Yeah. Yeah, what it's doing is it just a bit of self-discipline, you know, to do something which is difficult, which is hard to do. So that's one of the reasons. You know, just see if you can do that. You don't die, but, you know, you have all this craving, which is a legitimate sort of need for the body to sleep, and you just don't do it. You know, you really want to lie down. After 14 days, or 15 days, when you first lay down, oh, that's bliss. Ah. Oh. But other monks were doing it as part of the practice there, to actually just try it once, see what it's like. Just to strengthen a bit of your renunciation power. Same with the other stuff, you know, just eating only alms food. Well, that was okay. You know, just after a while. Trouble was that people got to know you were eating alms food and they make special food for you. So after a while it didn't work either. So these days, for the monks which I teach, just the ordinary rules is good enough. You don't need to do any of these ones. But, you know, they live simply. For the patch robes, I keep asking, it doesn't matter what type of robe you have. Some monks, they want sort of cotton robes or, you know, this right size robe, not too heavy. Just any old robe will do. So it's also important. But I do know some monks. It's not our group, but I won't tell you who they are. But they wear satin robes. And it's from the finest satin from Switzerland. And, I mean, that's crazy. What are you doing that for? And that is pretty much what it says here, because we are far better than these ordinary monks, because we wear high-quality satin robes. Crazy stuff. So anyway. Yeah? Yeah, I suppose so. If that's the only robe they've got, fair enough. But you'd be crazy to actually order one in from, yeah, satin patches. If that's all that's available, that's fair enough. Yeah. No, if that's all that's available, that's what you've got to take. Yeah. But if you've just got satin robe and cloth robe and sort of propylene robe, whatever it is, and say, yeah, that's the one I'll take, then that's really gross. But, you know, you'd be surprised that, you know, people actually do renounce and join these monastic orders, but they've got their old defilements and just their old ways of doing things, and it takes a while for them just to disappear. So you can see that sort of thing sort of happening. That's right, yeah, the one who's got the more patches on. I've got more patches than you have. Na 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 na. I've stayed more time not slowing down than you have. But you can see that all these things, because of pride, which is what this is talking about, that it's so easy, you know, to have spiritual pride. And also, don't have pride in your monastery or your teacher. Ah, no, we're the only place which has got a really good bhikkhuni monasteries. Over the east, they've got nothing. In other countries, they've got nothing. Only the BSWA has got the best nuns and the best monks. That is the character of an unskillful person.
It's true, though.
It's true, though. because that's not the way states of creed, hatred, and delusion are destroyed. So you can see here is focusing on lessening your greed, hate, and delusion. Now your wanting and your aversion, and especially as it comes out in thinking you are better or you are worse. And there's a consequence of this that the next part of the sutta starts to happen. When you're meditating, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from the five hindrance, is an unskillful person enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by movement of the mind towards the bliss and holding on to the bliss with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the five senses. And the first point I want to make is that this attainment in deep meditation does follow on quite naturally, you know, from a person who practices not praising themselves and disparaging others, but nevertheless who does live such a simple life. A person who does not worry about their gain or they're a great preacher. And the story I'd like to mention, for those of you who know some of the history of Buddhism, that the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, the Sangha, became a very good bhikkhu and got these deep meditations and psychic powers as well. And as soon as he got his psychic powers and these jhanas which came before, he got proud and he thought he was much better than other people, praising himself and disparaging others. And that's where he lost those powers. This is one of the problems. If you can let go of your sense of ego and self by not praising yourself and disparaging others because of these things which happen to you or your way you practice spiritual life, if you it's quite naturally that these states of jhanas will occur. It's the point which is implied here, which I'm bringing out from this sutta. So if you haven't had these jhanas yet, perhaps you are praising yourself, disparaging others, because of how you practice your lifestyle. Bit too much ego there. Maybe you might not do that explicitly, but implicitly or just thinking about it yourself. I've done more retreats than you have. Be careful. That stops you getting jhanas. So anyway, here comes the jhana bit. And for those of you who haven't seen my explanation before, sequences, that's one of the most important parts of it. And that is the sense of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch all turned off. You can't think. Obviously you can't see anything, you've got your eyes closed. And you can't even feel anything with your body. There's no heat, no cold, someone touches you, you wouldn't know it. So this is the five senses have stopped. And the sixth sense, the mind, is now dominant. At the same time, secluded from the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are wanting and aversion. So all that wanting and aversion, which causes the mind to move. When you want something, the mind moves towards what you want. Aversion pushes you away from where you are. All the restlessness, which is caused by the wanting and aversion, has been settled down. You're pretty still. Because of the stillness, your mind gets lots of energy. There's no sloth and torpor anymore. And there's no doubt because your mind is very clear and knows exactly what is going on. So these are the five hindrances. When those things are abandoned, this is what happens. The stillness means the whole body vanishes. And you're left with the mind. And abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by moving the mind towards the bliss and holding the bliss. This is what I keep calling the wobble. It's almost still, but not really quite perfectly still. Had a headache, and now you take some magic bullet medicine, and the headache for days disappears. That is and this is the nature of the happiness, the bliss, the ecstasy, which happens in this first deep meditation. When you're so still, all these five senses vanish. So that's the description. You've heard me say that before. He considers us. I have gained the experience of the first jhana, but these other bhikkhus have not gained the experience of the first jhana. So they praise themselves and disparage others because of their experience of the first jhana. This too is a characteristic of an unskillful person. Unfortunately, people do that. In the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi and I think Nyanamoli, they actually put their, where has it gone? I have gained the attainment of the first jhana. And I have actually changed that to gain the experience of the first jhana to make a very important point. This is not an attainment. It's an experience made of letting go. You don't attain these things. When you start to disappear, that's when these things happen. What about your sense of self, your ego, disappearing? And so you don't say, I've gained an attainment. It's not some thing you can, like a degree from university, which you can put on a wall. This is when things on the wall have vanished. So I call it gain the experience of the first jhana. But still, some people think that this is a personal attainment. I have got this, therefore I am better than other people. So you praise yourself and disparage others. But a skillful person considers thus, non-ownership of anything, even these spiritual experiences, has been declared by the Blessed One, even for the experience of the first jhana. I'm not going to go into the next sentence until I explain this one. This is like a word which, I remember when I first read this in Pali, I thought, wow, this is a great word. Atamayata. And if anyone who knows the work of Bhikkhu Buddhadasa in South Thailand, he became a very famous monk, passed away about 30 years ago, maybe longer. A very famous monk, and he wrote a whole book about just that one word, atamayata. Maya means making something out of something. It's used, for example, an astral body is called manomaya body. Mano means mind, mind made body. Mind maya body. And also you have things called sanya maya kaya, like perception, maya, made, body. So it's making something out of tam means that. You're making something out of that, a person, a being, out of that attainment. That's what I'm meaning. Not, and so at tamayata, when you put an at in front, it means the opposite. So the meaning of this word, which is quite an important word in Pali, not making something out of it, such as a possession or an attainment. So even if you've got this incredible experience of the first jhana, it's not yours. But you always remember the Buddha said, don't own these states. Don't make something out of it, such as a possession of an attainment. I just got jhanas. Because then the next thing is, I am better than those scallywags who don't. So a skillful person considers thus non-ownership, not making something out of it, such as a possession or an attainment, has been declared by the Blessed One, the Buddha, even for the experience of the first jhana, even something so big. And now comes a killer, one of my favorite sayings, for in whatever way they conceive it, it is always otherwise. Whatever way you think about it, you can never really quite get it, because conceiving is missing the point. Conceiving is, as somebody said years ago, I remember this statement, they said, you always think about something, which means you go around it like a satellite, like the moon going around the earth. You think about it, but you never think into it. You can't think into it, it always goes around the matter. So conceiving never gets close enough to penetrate into it. So whenever you conceive it, think about it, put it into words, try and get a concept, trying to contain it by some sort of philosophy, you'll always miss it. So in whatever way you conceive it, it is always otherwise. Yeah, you can describe these things, but the description, again, is the old Zen finger pointed at the moon, the signpost. Like my favorite simile I've been using, because a few months ago when I went to Dharamsala, I asked them, where's the toilet? And they said, over there, it's got the word, toilet. So I said, oh, That's the toilet over there, where the door where it says toilet. I said, yeah, it's got the sign on it. So I said, I'm going to urinate on the door. And he said, what are you talking about? Well, it says toilet on the door, so that must be the toilet, the door. I said, no, you do misunderstand. That's the sign. The sign is not the toilet. The toilet's inside the door. Now, you may think I'm being stupid there, but I'm making a point. You know, these words, you know, you don't urinate on the sign. The sign is pointing where the toilet is, the other side of that sign. And that's what many people do. They urinate on the sign, metaphorically, when it gets to things like jhanas and stuff. So whatever you conceive it to be, it is always otherwise. So, you know, the sign is not the thing. So, putting non-ownership, non-identification, they say, Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is pretty good. Non-ownership first. It's just, John, I don't own these things. I never attained it. They neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their experience of the first jhana. How can you praise yourself and disparage others? Because this is not an attainment, an ownership anymore. This too is a character of a skillful person. It's just like, you know, as a monk, it's one of our rules. I am not permitted. It's the eighth paticca. You can look it up for yourself. All this stuff is on the web these days. But as a monk, I'm not permitted to tell people about any of my meditation experiences, the deep ones. But, you know, sometimes people keep pressing me. Say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you've written all these books. Ajahn Brahm, honestly, come on, in front of everybody. Have you ever attained a jhana? That's how they say it. And I've got this great answer these days, which doesn't break my rules, but it also means I can actually explain an important point of Dhamma. And I say to people, and I usually put my head down and said, yeah, I've written all these books about jhana, but Ajahn Brahm cannot attain jhana. All these years, I'm being honest here, Ajahn Brahm has never attained a jhana. And people say, oh my goodness, you hypocrite. I've been following you all these years. I trust you. And now you just made these up. And then I do the killer statement. I said, Ajahn Brahm has to disappear, first of all. And then the jhanas happen. I have to get out of the way. I cannot attain anything except a lot more suffering. But when I vanishes, then these things happen. So there's a nice way of answering the question. Because everyone, I don't know, is it an attainment? Ajahn Brahm, can you please, all these things. Yes, I've got this attainment, that attainment. People love to think like that, but this is not the game of Buddhism. It's not an attainment, it's when you vanish, disappear. You get the point? Hope so. Anyway, this is the whole purpose of the sutta. You're not taking these things as attainments. So when they're not attainments, they're not personal, you don't own these things. It does mean that you'd never praise yourself nor disparage others because of the experience of these incredible things. Now the second jhana, with the stilling of the movement of the mind towards the bliss and hold out, that's the last bit of movement. An unskillful person enters upon the bias in the second jhana. That's the first time that nothing moves at all. Absolutely nothing. Really still. And with the fading away as well as rapture, you enter upon the third. I know that's half of the bliss, just because of stillness, everything settles down. And then the last, with the abandon of all pleasure and unpleasantness, both physical and mental, you enter upon the abiding of fourth jhana. And I'll just go there first of all. And an unskillful person thinks, I have gained the experience of these four jhanas, but these other monks have not gained the experience of these four jhanas, so they praise themselves and disparage others because of their experience of those jhanas. That's the character of an unskillful person, but a skillful person considers non-ownership, not making something out of this, has been declared by the Blessed One, Buddha, even with the experience of these four jhanas, for in whatever way they conceive it, it is always otherwise. So putting non-ownership first, they neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of the experience of these four jhanas. That is the character of a skillful person. So what it's saying over there, that you have to do this letting go of your sense of self to get into these jhanas for the first time, first place. But a lot of times I've seen this happen. People just, they get this first or second jhana or something, and the reason why they got in there. They totally forget. Yes, at last, I've got it. And they made something out of it. Sense of self. And that stops any further progress. They usually lose the jhanas afterwards. Yes. It's identity, because once there is a sense of I, automatically will come a sense of possession and control. And it's a controlling which causes the lack of stillness. They haven't trained themselves to perceive in terms of non-ownership enough. They've just done enough to get into the jhana, a temporarily, but then they forget it. And then they think, I don't own the robes, and yeah, renown and fame and all this other stuff, but jhana, yeah, I own that. Because it's big, it's huge. So that's one of the problems. At the last step, you get attached to these things. By being attached, I mean it's mine. I attained this, I did this. Look how great I am. So that's the point of this sutta, which is really beautiful. And if you do that, if you become an unskillful person, you can't get the jhana anymore until you become skillful again. Oh, it's just not mine, and I'm not going to praise myself and put down others who haven't got these things. And anyway, then we go to the four arupa states, because they always go through the whole lot in these suttas. So, 16. Moreover, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is not defined, an unskillful person enters upon and abides in the base of indefinite space. I'm just playing around with some new translations. Instead of infinite space, I've called it indefinite space. And this is these four arupa states. These are the states based on this fourth jhana, perfectly still, there at all. And by this time, all sort of pleasure and pain, mental and physical, have totally vanished, totally equanimous, really still. When you are still, things vanish. Just like the perception when there's a sound of the traffic in the background, the hum doesn't change, and after a while you can't hear it anymore. The nature of the brain and the mind, which is a separate thing, can only perceive change. Things which are always there, which don't move, are invisible. And it's the same when the mind becomes still, things start to vanish. And this is the perceptions of the mind in terms of any space start to go. The next one is where consciousness starts to vanish, because it also is very still. And the only way I've managed to get people to understand what it means is to refer to an experience which many meditators have when they get to the early stages of present moment awareness. Because in the present moment awareness, time has started to disappear. And it's indefinite, it's not bounded anymore, time, in the present moment. You don't count in what terms of minutes or hours. You don't. To have a perception of time, you need past and future, or present and future. You need two ends to measure it by. When it's only the present moment, only one end, one beginning, it's the same. It's like time starts to vanish. It's not defined anymore. Therefore, it's about to go. And that's how I understand this first arupa. The perception of space, extension, being inside a room, or just being nowhere. Time has vanished, now space vanishes for you. That's the first immaterial. The second immaterial is consciousness becomes indefinite. Where's the next one? Completely surmounting the base of indefinite space, aware that consciousness is not defined, an unskillful person enters upon and abides in the base of indefinite consciousness. And each one of these is unskillful, because then you start to make something out of it. By complete surmounting the base of indefinite consciousness, aware there's nothing, things have disappeared, nothing left, be perceived as nothing, an unskillful person enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness, so your perception is nothing there. And because you are aware of nothing, but you're still aware, it means your awareness, perception itself, is now about to go. By completely surmounting the base of nothingness, an unskillful person enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Go back to present moment awareness, just the closest thing I can get to get you to understand roughly what this is. Present moment, all the time in the world, but no time. Neither time nor no time. They consider thus, I have gained the experience of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But these other bhikkhus have not gained that experience, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So they praise themselves and disparage others because of their experience of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This too is the character of an unskillful person. So in each one of these four jhanas and the four arupa states, you can still take these as an attainment. If you do, you're going to praise yourself and put down others who haven't got this. And a beautiful line, but a skillful person considers us. Non-ownership, not making something out of it, not possessing these experiences, has been declared by the Blessed One. Even with the experience of the base of this neither perception nor non-perception. For in whatever way they conceive it, it is always otherwise. So did you understand what neither perception nor non-perception is? Of course you can't. Because whatever way you conceive it, it's going to be otherwise. Okay? So don't even try to conceive it. It says that you can't. All right. So putting ownership first. They neither praise themselves nor disparage others because of their experience of this, any of these jhanas or arupa states. That too is the character of a skillful person. You don't own anything. Yes, Eddie, you had a question. You can't even perceive its equanimity. You're almost totally gone. No, if it's real deep equanimity, which means you can't even feel your body anymore, that would be the fourth jhana. So these are really deep states. But anyway, Eddie, whatever way you conceive it, it's going to be otherwise. So don't conceive it. So you get in there, and then you have some idea what you're talking about. So those are the four jhanas, and again, and four rupas. And again, this is actually almost at the same time showing a whole practice. Not everybody goes through the four jhanas, or the four arupa states. They say the two different types of enlightened beings, or one who just goes through the four jhanas, they don't do the four arupa states, or one who goes through the whole eight. The two types of enlightened beings. And so that's just the path, and their outflowings, leaks, I've got in brackets here, I'll tell you why in a minute, are destroyed by the seeing with wisdom. The outflowings is the mind going out into the world, seeking happiness, seeking satisfaction, seeking validation outside. And the reason I put leaks in there, because a couple of weeks ago, somewhere recently, someone had been looking through the Chinese version of these sutras, the Agamas. And with this outflowings, they noticed the Chinese character meant leak, like a leak in a bucket, or like a leak in a pipe. That was a character for what's usually called taints, arsewas. And I thought, wow, what a cool word that was. The Chinese were really great in translating this Pali. And taints, which didn't mean anything. You may have come across that word when you read the version by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Leaks. The leaky mind. And losing its energy, losing its composure, always going out into the world. So a leaky mind. So those outflowings, those leaks, are destroyed by the seeing with wisdom. Such a monk, nun, lay person, whatever, this is the arahat, the fully enlightened one. When their outflows are destroyed, they do not conceive anything. they do not conceive in regard to anything. You do not conceive in anything. That's a nice killer statement over there. They don't think they're enlightened or not enlightened or whatever. They just don't conceive anymore. They don't have any sense of an identity. And you don't have an identity in regard to anything. Or not an identity in anything. You don't think you are now merged into the ultimate cosmic consciousness. You don't conceive in anything. All that stuff is gone, finished forever. Because whatever way you conceive it, it's always otherwise. That's the end of philosophy for you. Any philosophy students here? That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That's called the Saporissa Sutta. And for those of you who had gone to our committee meeting, there's quite a few of our committee members here. I didn't want to go on too long. You're probably already tired out, and especially you give so much in our committee meetings. It's nice to give you another aspect of it. It's much more fun than arguing about IT and computers and other building stuff. So this is my gift for you guys. Nice, beautiful, sort of, nice hot Dhamma. So any questions, any comments about the sutta today? Yeah. Anything, no. Because all thought misses the point. Yeah, it doesn't conceive, especially the conception that the word conceive has a special meaning in Buddhism. Because they have the three conceits. Conceit is related, yeah. You know, because we have that even in English. To conceive means to think, to actually come to some sort of conclusion by your thoughts, have an opinion, you conceive of something. For a woman, you give birth, which is a wonderful word. You're giving birth to something when you conceive. But we also have in English the conceit. Look how good I am. I am a monk. I sit up here and thousands of people listen to me. That's conceit. And especially the three conceits taught by the Buddha are the conceit, I am better than other people. That's the first conceit, and I understand that one. The second conceit is very common in a country like Australia. I am worse than others. What we call lack of self-esteem. That's also another type of conceit. And the killer one, number three, is I am the same as others. You're not the same as others. You're not worse. You're not better. There's a whole idea of conceit. Measuring you with others disappears when you realize there's no you to measure with. Okay, Tommy? Impermanent? Infinite to indefinite. Because infinite, first of all, people, it's too hard to get your head around the idea of infinite consciousness. And it doesn't really mean that. The word is anta. Anta means an end, a boundary, sort of an edge. It means like consciousness without an edge, without a bound. Yeah, you could call it infinite, but it means like with no nothing to describe it, to circumscribe it, to put it in books so you can really get your head around it. So not infinite in the sense of goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on, which is that word infinite, sometimes it has that connotation. It's the part is an, which means not, anta. And anta is the same as end. No end. Yeah, it's no end infinite, but it means much more than that. It means there's no wall surrounding it. So because of that, you can't describe it. Now, the word describe comes from scribe, means write something around it. Yeah. Well, that's not infinite. That's just a long... Infinite is much further than outer space. Yeah, because even that, Yeah, even space is not infinite. Ask any physicist. Yeah, we know exactly how much space there is in this universe. I don't know if any of you remember in physics that there's a really, really neat little demonstration, very simple maths, which actually proved that the universe cannot be infinite. And it would be illogical to be infinite. If it was, there'd be too much energy, we'd all be blasted by so many rays. It's a very neat proof. And it's not infinite, but there's no edge to it. Exactly, yeah. You describe yourself. You put these descriptions. You circumscribe yourself as being a woman. Or you put yourself in the box of being this particular age. So when you take out all those boxes, and people love boxes because it gives them sense of identity. They know where they are. They know where they stand. So it's a bit scary when you take all those boxes away. That's why, you know, it does take a lot of courage to disappear. But it's actually much better, because when you put those boxes on, you are in prison. Four walls defining you. And when you go outside of prison, you're undefined. It's scary for many people. Especially if you've lived in a prison all your life. And now you're walking out. I don't know who I am, what am I supposed to do? But you're free. Yeah, it's all about non-self. That's where conceit comes from a sense of self. Yes? Non-self over there. Yes, yeah, it's very common. Yeah. It's the same thing, whichever. Exactly, the opposite way around. So praising yourself, disparaging others. It's pretty much the same thing as disparaging oneself and praising others. Well, it depends. If you're talking about psychology, you can actually tell people a bit of self-affirmation. Just, yeah. In the Dharma, you don't even conceive of that anymore. But even on the way, you're encouraged. You know, like, you know, you've seen the way our monasteries work. Yeah, I sit at the top of the line, but I don't have special robes because I've been a monk for such a long time. You know, that sometimes people don't know who's the senior monk, who's not the senior monk. I'm not even the oldest anymore. You've got Ekagata, he's 74. And even, like, last week, I was sitting up there for the Dharma on a Saturday, Sunday, and I was the youngest. I was a young whippersnapper. Upasame was 74 and Ekagata 74, I'm only 64. I feel really out of place. They should be up the top. But who's better, who's worse? You don't... Who? Yeah. Yeah. How did they're not all the same? Welcome to the world. It's never going to be the same. Look, you've heard me say many times that the problem with people is always trying to improve themselves rather than trying to accept themselves. Trying to improve the monastery rather than trying to just... We've spent so much time building monasteries. Doesn't need to improve anymore. It's good enough. And you know, you're good enough. You don't have to improve yourself. You're not the best. You're not the worst. You're not the same. Wow, free at last. So if you're not the best, if you're the best, you get proud. If you're the worst, you've got a lot of work to do to catch up. Exactly. See? Yeah, anywhere is conceit. Because whatever you conceive it to be, it's always something else. Exactly. At last, I've got there. Don't worry about it. It's no judgment. Yeah, you can't judge anything. Because yeah, people don't know why they do things. You know, they've got their reasons for it, the conditioning. I don't know why they do things, but it's just why they do things. So we don't think you're better or you're worse or you're the same. All this conceit business, which causes so much hassle in this world. You know, I'm the Prime Minister, therefore I deserve to go in a helicopter. It wasn't the Prime Minister, was it somebody else? I've got questions from overseas. Oh my goodness. These are more important ones here. Those are the better ones. Okay. No. I'm from Hawaii. Dear Bhante, why is it that in some monasteries strictly enforce austere practices when the suttas here store practices are optional and only used to remedy certain habits? Exactly. In other words, the reason is because some of those monasteries in the past have just followed the example for their teacher rather than actually looked to see what the real tradition was. Where was I recently? I think it was in Singapore. No, in Malaysia. And people call me, you're just a really modern monk, Ajahn Brahm, the way you talk and the way you act. So I'm not a modern monk. I am the most traditional monk you can possibly find. Only my tradition goes back to the time of the Buddha. Other people's tradition goes 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. I go way back. That's my tradition. So I'm the most conservative traditional monk. I follow the Vinaya. Sort of. But the question here is, why do they enforce these austere practices? That's because they're following the example of their teacher. They're just doing what their teacher did, not really understanding why they did that. And this is the trouble, imitation rather than coming from wisdom. So we do what we're taught to do rather than being taught how to think and find out for oneself. From Hawaii, just before my teacher Ajahn Chah died, he would give the same story again and again for quite a few weeks. So if I keep repeating the stories, I'm just following the tradition of my teacher. And he would, I can't do this the way he did it. He'd get his hand out. He said, he made it, one day there was a crab who had a bad leg, so he'd walk with a limp. And the crab who walked with a limp had a lot of babies. And told all her children, he said, I walk with a limp because I've got a bad leg. Don't imitate me. Don't you walk with a limp as well. But all the little babies, they also walk with a limp because they were just imitating their mother. And Ajahn Chah was referring to himself. He said, look, the way I teach, you know, like everyone, we've all got limps. Don't just follow me. And of course, everyone just followed him. They always walk with a limp as well. In other words, they're following the teacher, not just the little baby crabs following their mother, not really thinking, you know, that the only reason why they walk with a limp is because they've got a bad leg. So, indeed, you're quite correct. Austere practices are optional and only used to remedy certain habits, indeed. So, if you force it on monks, then they don't know really what they're doing. It's not according to the Dhamma, and it's going to be bad results. The last one is, what is the difference between a sapurusa, a skillful person, and a seka, disciple in higher training? Is it a seka is a sapurusa, but not the other way around? Actually, you're onto something there from Malaysia, because a sapurusa, what I had a skillful person here, what they say in the Bhikkhu Bodhi is a true person, is sometimes used as a synonym for a stream winner. And the reason they call it a stream winner is because they've got away from especially self-view, sakaya ditti, the view that there is somebody in there. And so obviously someone who is a stream winner would be a sapurusa, and they would never think of any of these attainments or experiences rather as being a personal attainment. So you're actually onto something there for as the poorest a skillful person is. At least a stream winner, someone in higher training. And equivalent, not one is bigger than the other. And lastly, from California, what is the purpose of chanting? Why some monks don't say excuse me when they burp? It is. There's two different questions there. But anyway, the purpose of chanting, it started off as a way of memorizing the teachings, because they didn't have any books or no tablets. So the only way you could remember the teachings was to keep chanting them to every day sometimes. So we had these chants, they kept on doing to preserve the teachings. They would memorize them like you memorize the Hamlet, Shakespeare. And many, many actors have to memorize this. And they chant it together so they can actually remember it, so when it's time to perform, they can perform it. In those days, because there was no books, the only way to preserve the teachings of the Buddha was to keep chanting it together. Now, after that, it became a tradition. It was like considered meritorious to chant. So you invite the monks into your house to chant. And again, it all just came from just a time when we didn't have books, but people still invite the monks to chant. I don't mind going to chant because, you give it some energy. It's like, why do people chant at the football matches? Because, sometimes it doesn't mean very much, but it does actually encourage the team. People are cheering for you. So it has that benefit, for people. And if you have got some good meditation, a strong mind, actually with the chanting, you can actually put a lot of mental energy into that chanting and can have some power. But sometimes the chanting, the tradition has got so strange. Please, I don't like knocking any culture, but the chanting in Sri Lanka, especially all-night spirit chanting, now that really deserves to be sort of criticized. Because they only do like three little suttas and takes all night. I don't mind, people say it's tradition, but I don't know where the tradition came from. It certainly didn't come from the time of the Buddha. It's one syllable that just Namo Tassa starts off. Na and maybe another couple of minutes before you get on to the next syllable, Mo. Now, honestly, when I first heard this, I was trying to be respectful, and it was one of the hardest things for me not to laugh, because there's very senior monks doing that, and I didn't really want to laugh. But come on, if anyone in Sri Lanka is listening to this, please, come on, it's getting into the 21st century. This is not really Buddhism, and it pushes a lot of people away from Buddhism. That's why I don't want to sort of hurt anyone's feelings, but that's past its use by date. Well, why monks don't say excuse me when they burp? Sometimes I told some monks, "Oh, excuse me," but then I thought, no, I don't really mean that. I have to be honest. Why should I be excused? I ask for excuse when I'm just doing a natural bodily function. You burp? That's nature. Is there anyone here who doesn't burp? Even online, looking at this. You burp, I burp. You pass wind, I pass wind. Why should I say sorry for doing a natural bodily process? So I am going to form a society of burpers' freedom rights. The right to burp. So that's one of the reasons why, because I'm making a point. That it's a bodily function, you can't really control it, it's just what happens to your body. So if you burp, just burp, for goodness sake. I can't apologize for things I didn't do, I had no control over it, it was unintentional. So anyway, that's why monks don't say excuse me when they burp. Just burp and get it over and done with. And if you think I'm bad for that, please don't disparage me and praise other monks who do apologize for burping. Okay, very good question there. Thank you for California. Okay, you got another one from here. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Yeah. But Exactly, you don't know what you're doing. So it is devotion coming from faith, which is a wonderful thing. But after a while, if they have faith in something which later on they find has no real meaning, it destroys their faith. So if people have faith, let's channel that energy into something which is really useful, rather than wasting it. So always remember, faith, you know, is something to be channeled like any other energy. You know, water can be a tsunami and can, you know, cause great destruction, or it can be tidal power, one of the great answers to the energy crisis. So it's how we make use of these things. Oh yeah, but I get into trouble for it. But I don't mind getting into trouble. Trouble is my middle name, Ajahn Trouble Brahm. Okay, so I think that's enough for today. It's just gone over 4:20. So thank you again for listening from overseas and for listening in here. We're now going to pay respects to the Buddha Dharma Sangha.
Arahan Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhan Bhagavantan Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.